The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues for the next half hour. I'll be reading articles, at least initially, from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. And the first useful article is entitled Actinic Keratosis, Skin Spots That Develop Over Time. You've accepted that your hairline has shifted during the past decade, but those rough, scaly patches high on your forehead, those are new, and even with vigilant moisturizing, they aren't improving. A trip to the clinic yields a diagnosis of actinic keratosis. Actinic keratosis results from an overgrowth of keratin, a protein in the skin. It's caused by exposure to ultraviolet rays, typically from the sun. It affects about 14% of people, and in some cases can develop into squamous cell carcinoma, a type of skin cancer. This progression to cancer is somewhat rare, but is more likely when actinic keratoses are left untreated. Actinic keratoses may appear as rough, scaly patches or crusts on the top layer of the skin. The lesions may range in color, including white, pink, red, gray, and flesh-colored, and are darker on black and brown skin tones. They're usually 1 inch or less in size and are found primarily on areas exposed to the sun, including the face, lips, ears, back of the hands, forearms, scalp, and neck. There may be a single lesion, but often there are multiple. Actinic keratoses take years to develop and usually first appear in older adults. The patches grow slowly and usually are not itchy or painful. People most likely to develop actinic keratoses have one or more risk factors, including a history of frequent or intense sun exposure. This may include spending a lot of time outdoors in the summer or living in an area with year-round sun. Pale skin. Blonde or red hair, especially when coupled with blue, hazel, or green eyes. Baldness also increases risk. A tendency to freckle or burn when exposed to sunlight. Or a weak immune system as a result of chemotherapy, HIV/AIDS, or an organ transplant. Early treatment can eliminate almost all actinic keratoses before they have the chance to become skin cancer. Several approaches can be used, and the first is freezing or cryotherapy. For this procedure, a healthcare professional will apply liquid nitrogen to the affected skin. This causes a freezing injury to the keratosis, which leads to blistering or peeling. As your skin heals, the damaged cells slough off, allowing new skin to appear. Cryotherapy is the most commonly used treatment. It takes only a few minutes and can be done in your care team's office. Side effects may include blisters, scarring, changes to skin texture, infection, and changes in skin color of the affected areas. Next is medications. If you have several actinic keratoses in a cluster or a field area of skin, your care team might prescribe a medicated cream, like fluorouracil, which is called Effudex or Carac. They may also prescribe imiquimod, which is called Zyclera, or diclofenac to remove them. This is sometimes called a field treatment. These products typically cause inflamed skin, scaling, and a burning sensation for a few weeks. A major study found that fluorouracil did significantly better than other medications in removing the lesions and preventing them from becoming cancer over a year of use. Finally, there's photodynamic therapy. A dermatologist might apply a light-sensitive chemical solution to the entire area of affected skin and then expose it to a special light that will destroy the actinic keratosis. Side effects may include inflamed skin, swelling, and a burning sensation during therapy. Talk to your care team about your treatment options. The procedures vary in the number of sessions required. Side effects and the risk of scarring also are important considerations. Actinic keratoses are usually very responsive to treatment. After treatment, you'll likely have regular follow-ups to watch for new lesions. Sun safety after treatment is critical. To minimize the risk of developing further actinic keratoses, regularly use sunscreen and sun protective clothing to protect your skin from harmful UV rays. Now we're going to turn to another article in the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. And again, it's an important topic, which is sleep apnea. John Bishop was visiting his cardiologist to discuss his high blood pressure. During his visit, he mentioned his wife commenting on his snoring. The cardiologist suggested he do an overnight sleep test, which revealed startling results. He averaged 52 pauses in breathing an hour, a notably high number. His blood oxygen level had dipped as low as 82% during the night. In this test, values under 90% are considered low. John was diagnosed with obstructive sleep apnea. The condition affects an estimated 15% of older adults and occurs more commonly in those who, like John, have other cardiovascular conditions or are overweight. The sleep specialist prescribed a continuous positive airway pressure device called CPAP. Eventually, John found a CPAP mask that worked and was comfortable to wear all night. The mask, plus significant weight loss thanks to changed diet and exercise routines, caused a dramatic improvement in both his blood pressure and his energy levels. If you have sleep apnea, you'll likely feel sleepy or fatigued during the day, especially after lunch, while driving, or during periods of inactivity. You may wake up in the morning with a headache and feel mentally dull, with a sense that your sleep wasn't refreshing. Other symptoms include high blood pressure, irritability, insomnia, decreased sex drive, irregular heartbeat, and dry mouth. During sleep, the muscles in the back of the throat relax. These muscles keep the airway open by providing support to structures in the mouth and throat, like the small teardrop-shaped tissue, the back of the throat called the uvula, the soft palate, the tonsils, and the tongue. With obstructive sleep apnea, these structures collapse and obstruct airflow. Obstruction of airflow leads to lower oxygen levels in your blood. After 10 to 30 seconds of insufficient exchange of air, your brain senses the problem and rouses you to a lighter level of sleep or brief wakefulness. The muscles then regain their usual tone. The obstruction is relieved, possibly with a snort, and you resume breathing. This temporary stop in breathing is called apnea. This pattern can repeat itself dozens to hundreds of times every night. Though many with sleep apnea aren't aware of these interruptions and think they sleep well, the repetitive obstructions prevent you from reaching the deep restorative phases of sleep and lead to tiredness during the day. Obstructive sleep apnea can happen to anyone, but it's diagnosed more often in people who are overweight and in men. The condition also becomes more common in women after menopause. Untreated obstructive sleep apnea can lead to other challenges, including with your weight and your mood. One of the most serious consequences of daytime sleepiness is an increased risk of accidents while driving or at work. In addition, trouble concentrating and lack of energy can challenge your productivity and relationships. The drops in blood oxygen level that occur with apnea also lead to increased blood pressure and strain on the cardiovascular system. Obstructive sleep apnea has been linked to high blood pressure, coronary artery disease, heart attack, heart failure, heart rate changes, stroke, blood clots, and diabetes. See your healthcare team if you or a bed partner has noticed any of these symptoms. Pauses in breathing during sleep, snoring that's loud enough to disturb another person's sleep or wake you up from sleep, and excess daytime drowsiness, which may cause you to fall asleep while you're working, watching television, or driving. Sometimes testing for sleep apnea can be performed in your home, but a study in a sleep clinic is often needed to confirm and optimize treatment for obstructive sleep apnea. Because treatments for sleep disorders differ, it is important to obtain an accurate diagnosis and fully understand your sleep condition. Some lifestyle measures may help keep your airway open during sleep. One is to change your sleep position. Sleeping on your back can cause your tongue and soft palate to rest against the back of your throat and block your airway. To stop yourself from sleeping on your back, try sewing a pocket or a sock on the back of your pajamas and placing a tennis ball inside. There are also commercially available devices and specially shaped pillows to prevent you from sleeping on your back. Also, you should avoid triggers. Alcohol, sedatives, and sleeping pills further relax the muscles in the back of the throat and can make sleep apnea worse. Move more, weigh less. Even small reductions in excess weight, when maintained, can produce long-lasting improvement in sleep apnea, blood pressure, and quality of life. Regular exercise improves sleep apnea as well as quality of sleep. Often self-care measures alone don't provide adequate relief for sleep apnea. Your healthcare team likely will encourage you to try other treatments. The first is CPAP, or positive airway pressure. This is generally the first line of treatment of obstructive sleep apnea. The most studied, reliable device is one that applies continuous positive airway pressure. Through a mask you put over your nose, the mask is connected to a machine that increases the pressure of the air you breathe. The pressure is just enough to keep your upper airway passages open, preventing apnea events. This form of treatment can cut out snoring, dramatically improve the quality of your sleep, eliminate excess daytime sleepiness, and may help lower your blood pressure. Many different types of masks are available. Some styles don't cover the nose or mouth, but rather sit under your nose or use soft prongs that go into the nostrils. With a little experimenting and by working with a sleep care specialist, most people find a CPAP mask that provides a comfortable and secure fit. Once a suitable mask is found, most people appreciate how much better they feel when they use it. CPAP devices have a variety of comfort features, which can reduce the pressure as you exhale, as well as warm and moisten the air for comfort. Some units provide adjustable levels of pressure. Besides CPAP devices, there are also oral appliances. For mild to moderate obstructive sleep apnea, wearing a dental appliance designed to open your throat by bringing your jaw and tongue slightly forward at night may be an option. The oral appliances need to be worn every night. Still, regular follow-up with your sleep care specialist and dentist is important to ensure that you're getting the right kind of therapy. Then there's medication. In late 2024, the Food and Drug Administration approved tirzepatide, or Zepbound, as the first prescription medication to treat obstructive sleep apnea. The drug is indicated for people with obesity in addition to moderate to severe sleep apnea. Finally, there's surgery. If a CPAP machine isn't right for you and you don't benefit from other treatments, your care team may recommend surgery to keep your airway open or increase the size of your airway. Several procedures are available, including removing some of the soft tissue at the back of the throat, repositioning the jaw, or implanting an electronic device that stimulates the nerves that keep your airway open. Work with your care team to decide which procedure is right for you. Now here's another very useful article from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. I should mention that this is the Mayo Clinic Health Letter of March 2025, and it's an article about saturated fats. For decades, saturated fats have been a dietary no-no. These fats often come from animal sources like red meat, processed meat, and full-fat dairy products like butter and yogurt. Saturated fats can raise your low-density lipoprotein cholesterol level, called LDL, your bad cholesterol, as well as your total cholesterol. Healthcare professionals encourage limiting the calories you get from saturated fat. The Dietary Guidelines for Americans recommend limiting saturated fat to 10% or less of your daily calories. The American Heart Association suggests no more than 6% of your daily calories come from saturated fats. However, recent years have brought a new look at saturated fats' risks and potential benefits, with vigorous discussion among health and wellness experts about its role in a well-rounded diet. Some suggest the once-forbidden foods containing these fats may be beneficial in moderate amounts as sources of protein, iron, and other nutrients. The consensus that eating foods with high levels of saturated fats caused heart disease was based in large studies first conducted in the 1960s and 70s. The findings have influenced health policy, medical recommendations, and personal dietary choices ever since. One example was the widespread move away from butter in favor of oil-based synthetic replacements like margarine that lacked saturated fat. In recent decades, researchers have taken a fresh look at these early studies. Critics of the studies argue that while the results show that diets low in saturated fat generally lead to lower levels of unhealthy cholesterol, they don't prove a cause and effect relationship between high levels of saturated fat and heart disease. Additionally, some of the studies left out some key details and included undisclosed conflicts of interest. Newer research in the United States and other countries suggests that full-fat milk, cheese, and yogurt may not have the negative effects on heart or vascular health they were previously thought to have. People with heart disease, high cholesterol, and other associated risk factors should follow their health care team's advice when it comes to saturated fat. Those without such conditions may be able to enjoy some dairy foods as part of a heart-healthy diet and lifestyle. But how? Fermented dairy foods like yogurt and kefir are high in saturated fat, but those not loaded with added sugar provide dietary benefits. They have live active cultures that may support healthy gut bacteria. These good bacteria help improve some cardiovascular risk factors, lower blood glucose, and regulate insulin levels. Even less nutritious foods heavy in saturated fats like ice cream, French fries, and bacon may have a place in your diet, provided you reserve them as special treats rather than daily staples. In addition, remember that saturated fats are just one component of your all-round diet. In general, eat plenty of fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and lean proteins like chicken and fish. Eat fried foods rarely or not at all. Use healthy, unhydrogenated oil for cooking, like canola, safflower, sunflower, or olive oil. Now we're going to turn to a section of the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. It's called Second Opinion. Question: Years ago, I got a tattoo. Now I wish I hadn't. Can my tattoo be removed safely? I've heard the process can be quite painful. If you're wishing you had done a little more thinking before inking, you're not alone. Or perhaps your tattoo was meaningful in another phase of your life but is now unwanted. As more Americans get tattoos, about 32% of adults have one, regrets are growing. Among people with tattoos, 18 to 30% say they wish they hadn't gotten them. A tattoo is meant to be permanent. The ink is placed beneath the surface of your skin in the second skin layer called the dermis, so it doesn't disappear with the normal shedding of skin cells. But that also makes the ink more complicated to remove. Still, there are ways to lighten and in some case remove an unwanted tattoo. The first step is to talk to a dermatologist or other skin care professional about whether you're a good candidate for tattoo removal. The size, color, and location of your tattoo, as well as your skin color, all affect the outcome. The skin care professional also can help you understand what's involved and what to expect. This can include possible side effects, like scarring or discoloration of the skin. A common way to remove or lighten a tattoo is through laser treatment, using Q-switched lasers. These emit a pulse of energy that breaks the tattoo ink into tiny pieces. Over several weeks, your body's immune system eliminates the ink particles. It's true that laser tattoo removal can be somewhat painful. Some liken it to the sensation of snapping a thin rubber band against the skin. If the pain is bothersome, a numbing cream can be applied to the skin beforehand. After a treatment, the area around your tattoo may be swollen, and your skin may blister or bleed. Several treatments over time may be needed to lighten or remove the tattoo, with a few weeks between treatments for your skin to heal. Often it's not possible to remove all evidence of a tattoo. The skin care professional can provide reasonable expectations, but after repeat sessions, the tattoo may fade to a level you're happy with. Or you might consider covering the remaining tattoo with a different tattoo. With a multicolored tattoo, you may need treatment with multiple lasers. That's because different colors absorb different energy wavelengths. Dark blue and black inks are easier to remove, while green, red, and yellow are harder. Sometimes there are medical reasons to remove a tattoo. For example, if you have an allergy to the ink or develop a scar over the tattoo, in that situation, your care team would determine the best method to remove the ink. As for at-home removal kits you may have seen advertised, these are not approved by the Food and Drug Administration. These kits haven't been proved to be effective and may sometimes be harmful. Now, another article from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter, the March issue, and it's entitled Surgical Treatments for COPD. When was the last time you had to think about breathing? For most people, inhaling and exhaling is a second nature. But for those living with COPD, or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, breathing isn't something to take for granted. COPD describes a group of progressive lung disease that include emphysema and chronic bronchitis. As the name implies, COPD obstructs airflow, making it more difficult to exhale and often causing breathlessness, especially during physical activity. As a result, you may have difficulty completing or enjoying daily tasks and can experience symptoms like wheezing, chest tightness, and chronic cough. COPD is typically caused by long-term exposure to harmful chemicals or fumes, especially by smoking. Rarely, it can be caused by an inherited alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. Numerous management strategies exist for COPD, including inhalers and oxygen therapy. Recently, effective surgical options have emerged. There's four main surgical options. The first is lung volume reduction surgery. With emphysema, The lungs commonly becomes hyperexpanded, and these overinflated portions compress healthier parts of the lung. In lung volume reduction surgery, the non-functioning parts are removed, allowing healthier portions more room to expand and function. Lung volume reduction can help some people live better and longer with COPD, but it's not a cure. Then there's endobronchial valve surgery. This surgery, called endoscopic lung volume reduction, also focuses on decreasing the lung size to improve breathing. A slender scope inserted through the mouth is used to place small endobronchial valves in the overinflated lobes of the lung. These valves help trapped air to leave the lung, and over time the damaged portion deflates. Then there is bullectomy. COPD can damage small air sacs over time, and the lung may be left with large pockets of air rather than clusters of alveoli. A bullectomy is a type of surgery that removes bullae to improve lung function and airflow. Bullectomy may be performed as an open surgery or as a minimally invasive procedure. And finally, there's lung transplant. With a transplant, we take out the damaged lungs and replace them with healthier lungs, says Dr. Kasivi. In general, transplant is a very good treatment for emphysema, but there are important considerations. There can be serious complications, and there is a need for lifelong medications that suppress the immune system. For some people, it's the best option to make breathing easier and improve your quality of life. Well, looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.